Welcome to Catherine Flynn's podcast, Intelligent Edge Yoga, conversations for smart, compassionate practice. Each episode will guide and inquire into ethics-based spirituality within a modern paradigm of practice. Whether your practice is yoga, Ayurveda, meditation, or simply living a life full of intention, this is for you. I'd like you to take a moment to consider supporting this podcast through Patreon. Your pledges enable the continuation of the podcast. Patrons will also receive exclusive resources, behind-the-scenes material for instructors, guided yoga and meditation sessions for yogis, and everything in between. This is just the start of something new and exciting. You can be a part of it by going to patreon.com/intelligentedgeyoga and clicking on the large orange button. Thanks.
Welcome to Intelligent Edge Yoga, yoga conversations for smart, compassionate practice with Catherine Ann Flynn. I'm Catherine. Good morning, Michael.
Hi, good morning, Catherine. Great to be here.
Good. Thank you so much for making the time. I know you're a busy man.
Oh, well, I am, but I also love doing podcasts. It's one of my favorite things to do because I see it's a great opportunity to talk about things I love and invite other people into my world. So I thank you for asking me.
My pleasure. And you already have quite a global audience and you're quite the traveler. Where have you been recently?
Most recently, Taipei and Japan. I was in Japan for a couple of conferences during the last summer. I was in Taipei in the fall. And then a lot of places within the United States and Canada as well. And then this year I'm going back to Taipei. I'm coming to Toronto for the Toronto Yoga Show in April. I'm out and about and I love it. I'm not as young as I used to be, but it's funny. The older I get, the more I enjoy traveling and the more I seem to be able to do it with a greater ease. So I'm all for it. And I'm getting booked up for 2020 right now. I'm going to the UK too this year. So that's a big first, taking the work there.
Delightful. Which part of the UK?
It's going to be in London. Yeah.
Very nice. Are you going to try yoga?
No, it's one of our practitioners, Phoenix Rising Practitioners, who has, it's called Unity Yoga, I think. She has a studio and also does our Phoenix Rising work there and has a pretty strong clientele and wants to have other people trained to do the work, which is a really great thing because a lot of practitioners, they think, oh, wow, if someone else is trained, it means it's going to be less for me. But she has the different attitude that there's room for all of us. And so I love it. Love the idea. Yeah.
I like that approach. I've tried to take the approach of training people so that I can attend classes with methods that I enjoy.
Isn't that great?
That's what you do is the upscaled approach. You train people so that you can visit countries that you'd like to visit. That's good. That's my long-term growth plan.
Yeah, I do. I love it. I love the culture. I learn a lot from culture when I go to a different place. You know, I've learned so much in Japan. I've been there 5 times in probably the last 4 years. And so I've really taken it on to each time I go, explore a little more deeply. And I think I've visited 9 different temples in the Tokyo area and several outside of Tokyo and various hot springs and, you know, all of that good stuff. But it's great. It's wonderful, as well as learning about the culture and learning about little ways of being that are part of Japanese culture that I think are just so compatible with our work in yoga.
Very cool. My partner lived in Japan for 2 years and little stories come out once in a while. And he actually, we were just talking about how much he appreciated their support to healthcare because we were talking about an eye exam. He hadn't had an eye exam since he lived in Japan. Yeah. And he said they send a bus around to all the schools. Yeah. And they do an extremely thorough physical for students and staff. And he said, you know, something funny is they told me that I needed to lose weight. And this man, he's tall and super slim. But based on Japan's version of BMI, absolutely, he was overweight.
Absolutely. Didn't fit the profile at all. Yeah.
No, he didn't. I think he'd probably have to take off a limb to get within a normal range.
Yeah. That's great. Yeah. So is he going back, taking you?
Well, actually, I mean, offline, I should probably ask you for some travel advice because it's not set in stone yet, but there's the possibility I actually might be teaching in Asia next year.
Oh,
which is, yeah, it's very exciting and new. Well, not next year anymore. It's this year. So
this year, yeah.
So we'll see, because of course, you know, it's interesting how maps give us such a skewed perception of space. Because he has a sister in Australia, which we'll get to in a second. He has a sister in Australia, and I'm chatting about going to a studio in the Philippines and maybe teaching in Indonesia and Hong Kong. And so, of course, to us, we're like, we'll just go to them all because on a map, they're very close together.
Well, they're not that far apart. It's all relative, I guess.
And you started in Australia.
I did. And actually, I forgot to mention that. I went back for the opening. I was actually the opening keynote at the Yoga Australia conference in March of 2018. And that was just a huge honor. I mean, I felt so great that here I was. I'd left Australia to follow my yogic path in 1984. And here I was, you know, how many years, 34 years later, going back and being the opening keynote at the biggest conference on yoga that they have in Australia. It was just a real honor, you know, it came together full circle beautifully. It was just a wonderful experience.
That must have been very meaningful.
Yeah, I've been back to Australia quite a lot since I've been here. I was going back every year once to visit my mom, but when she passed, I didn't have the reason to do that. But I still love to go back, but I live here now. I'm a citizen of the United States and very pleased to be one and to be able to enjoy the wonderful benefits of living here and living in North America. And all the folks are north of the border. I love them too. And
oh, thanks for the shout out. We appreciate it. Canadians love it when we get mentioned on American news in a positive way.
My trips to Montreal and Toronto and Vancouver are some of my favorite places.
But it was not a direct, I don't believe it was a direct shot from Australia to the US. There was a detour.
Yeah, pretty much was, yeah.
Was it? Okay.
Yeah, for several years before that, I did live in Papua New Guinea to the north of Australia. But I was a professor in a college in Australia, had the dream job. I was teaching stuff that I love to teach. And
what were you teaching?
It was basically organizational change, organizational behavior, behavioral psychology, basically.
Cool.
Particularly with an emphasis on how people change. So you can see how this kind of fits into yoga.
And what was the trend when you were teaching? What were the big themes in behavioral psychology of the era?
Yeah, it was all transformation, interpersonal relationships. You know, a lot of the stuff that came out of Esalen in the 60s started to creep into the business world. I remember going to an encounter group at a university in Australia that was run by the psychology department, and it was down and out, straight from Esalen. You know, the whole Fritz Perls method.
Yeah, the human potential movement. It's very exciting.
The human potential movement, exactly. That's it. Yeah, you named it. So I was a workshop junkie. I used to go to all these things, and one thing led to another, and I got into yoga, and then I decided, wow, this stuff. I was practicing one morning, and my eight-year-old daughter looking at me, and she said, "Dad, I like when you do that stuff." And I said, "Why is that?" She said, "Well, when you do that stuff, you don't get so grumpy." And I thought, wow, that's interesting. Here I am, I'm dealing with change. I'm teaching people how to change. And my eight-year-old daughter's telling me I'm changing right before her eyes by doing some stuff with my body. You know, so it's like, maybe there's more to this. So that got me really curious.
But then you did live in an ashram for a period of time, or studied in an ashram?
That was in the United States. That was actually at Kripalu. I moved in 1984 to go to Kripalu, which in those days was an ashram. It wasn't like it is now. You know, it's now a world-class yoga standard, but then in those days it was an ashram with, you know, the white robes and the beads and the guru and all that kind of stuff. And so I went there for a year to do a postgraduate degree, a self-study into transformational change, to see how because I was curious about how this yoga lifestyle and practices and everything else would actually change me. And so I got approval to do a self-study for a graduate program. And
so the graduate program was located out of a sort of official university?
No, it was actually in Vermont. It was the original Goddard program that had been bought by Norwich University and was part of the their Montpelier campus, which is set up for independent study programs.
Mm.
So it was funny. It was like actually a military school that had bought a kind of a hippie program. And
I don't know. It sounds like I've done graduate school and it was definitely not good for one's health or for exploring human potential. Yeah. I would really like to do a hippie master's degree.
Yeah, this was, but it was not easy. I mean, it was rigorous. I had to really, make sure I had something substantive to show for all of my, enthusiasm. And so I did a lot of reading. I did a lot of research, and I did a particularly a good hard look at myself. And that's what sealed the deal, of course. And I could have gone back to Australia to my wonderful job because I was on sabbatical. I was actually getting paid to be here while I was studying and living in an ashram. I thought, this is where I want to go. And so I went back and resigned my job. Everyone thought I was crazy because, I had tenure, I had all the things that people look for in a great academic job. But it just spoke to me that I needed to follow this path. You know?
Have you ever watched the TED Talk by Sir Ken Robinson? He's an educational specialist in the UK, and he talks about how education kills creativity and how we teach kids it's more important to be right than to try.
Yeah.
And in it, he talks about, and I so resembled this comment, that academics sometimes see their bodies as transportation for their heads.
Oh, totally. That's a great line. I like that one.
Yeah, it's a good one. But now I'm seeing, and I have to admit, I'm a little bit jealous because I left a PhD to go into marketing and then ultimately wound up in yoga because I'd been teaching and practicing all along. But now I'm seeing people do PhDs in yoga in these official institutions. And when I left, no one suggested that that was a possibility.
Right.
And I imagine that you probably felt like those two worlds just couldn't live together.
I got very lucky that, I was probably one of the first to ever do a graduate program in yoga therapy. I mean, no question. I don't think anyone before me had ever done that. The library at the university that I got my degree from are very proudly kind of putting my dissertation out there as one of the first in a new field. So
that's very exciting. Now people, one of the things that I found frustrating sometimes was that whenever I would produce a paper, it just depended on the prof that I was working with. And I would be reticent to show it to too many of them because they would always want me to do a literature review of the people that they felt were very meaningful, whether they were tethered to the field or not. So half your paper was talking about everything that had come before you.
Yeah.
And then you got to say
also about me. That was the cruncher because I had to connect the dots. How was my experience in any way relevant to what I was reading? Did it connect?
Yeah. Yeah. So you lived at the ashram for a year.
A little over a year, probably close to 2 years. Yeah.
But you didn't stay. Why didn't you stay? Because your program was over?
Well, I had a family. When I came, I was actually married to my first wife. We had two kids and they came with me and we all lived in the ashram together, which was a pretty interesting experience. It was unusual. Not too many married couples were allowed to do that. So we got permission to do that and lived in very small, tiny quarters. I mean, I can remember my daughter saying, I can't eat any more brown rice because I don't like anything else.
The food at Kripalu has got a lot better.
Yeah. Back in those days, it was 50 cents a meal was the budget for catering, for the ashram. So, there wasn't a lot there, but it was great. I mean, it was a great experience. I learned so much out of that experience. And it was where I had really and one of the reasons I did decide to stay was through my yoga experience. I had a couple of personal experiences that really sealed the deal on, yoga as a transformational path.
And so it was that experience that you thought this can be
Yeah.
This can be of service. I can do more than for just myself.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the first one, I was actually not long after we were here, in the second year that we were here, you know, my ex-wife and I decided that we would go our separate ways. And that was very, very painful for me. I was like, you know, really, really having a hard time with it, because it was, you know, it was a significant time. We'd been together and had two children, and, you know, it was a strong bond. And so I had a lot of letting go to do it. It was hard, and I felt very, quite emotional about it. But I'd get up in the morning. It was around about this time I was starting to deepen my practice. And deepen practice means to me, it means becoming more aware, going into the actual experience in a more focused, concentrated way. So I was doing that, and I'd get on my mat every morning, and within a couple of minutes of doing a few postures, I'd start to cry. The tears would just well up, and I'd be like, you know, a blubbering mess on the mat. And so what I decided to do was just to really continue and to really engage the postures, but go into my body and really be present to the visceral experience of the regret, the loss, the sadness, all of that stuff that was there. I just go in and be really, really, really present to it, and just really not try to figure it out, not trying to ask why is this happening, and, you know, our usual way of doing it in our intellectual way. I didn't do that. I resisted that and just went into the pure experience. And it very quickly transported me into a different state of being. So when I get up off the mat to go about my day, I felt like I could face the day. I felt, you know, like, yeah, life is not so bad. Life is pretty good. You know, I can deal with this. And I was telling a friend about this, and he said, oh, that's like the phoenix. I said, what do you mean like the phoenix? He said, well, you know, the phoenix is a bird. It dies into the fire, gets all burned up, and then it comes out the other side, and it's really beautiful. I said, yeah, that's exactly how I feel. I feel that in my body. He said, that's the phoenix rising. And I thought, phoenix rising, huh. And so that's how my work came to be known as phoenix rising yoga therapy. But that came a few years later. It just came, the concept came to me though in that moment. And then I had another experience in the ashram where I was actually doing partner and assisted yoga with a friend, Don Stapleton. He was one of my mentors at that time. And he had me against a wall in a triangle posture. And it was a similar experience where I went right deep into the sensation of the stretch. But he was there with his hand on my chest supporting me and also reminding me to breathe, but I was tending to hold back a little bit. I went to that. And it wasn't a physical edge so much. There was a physical edge there. I was at the edge of that, you know, not too much, not too little sensation, but it was more an inner experience. I had, you know, colors and felt burning sensations and felt a whole kaleidoscope of different feelings. Had no idea what it was about. Just a different range of feelings and emotions and thoughts and images, a lot of stuff just pouring on like a movie in rapid time, you know. And I got a little scared, but he put his hand on my chest and he encouraged me to breathe again and just to really stay there with it. So I did. And it started to shift. So I went from like this really not very pleasant state to a much more pleasant state, and eventually into what I would even call bliss. You know, I felt, wow, I could stay here all day. I didn't, of course. You know, we came out of the posture and I wanted to talk about it, but he had to go to a meeting, so I didn't. But I went back to my room and I journaled, and I found out that in my early childhood, I'd even forgotten about this. I had an experience where I got beaten up by some bullies, you know, and it was really painful and traumatic. And some of those same feelings were what I'd felt in the experience. But I hadn't quite exactly put the label on it. But that just came to me in retrospect in sort of an integration time. And then as I walked around, I just noticed I felt different, and I started to look people in the eye, and I started to have different conversations with people. I felt more confident. And there was a fear that had kind of gone. I think it was a fear of big people or something. And it was just this fear of getting hurt or getting, if I was too open or too, you know, so that kind of, it went. And it wasn't any effort. So I started to look at, you know, some of the literature and thought, that's what transformation is. Transformation is like this metamorphosis, a shift in one way of being to another. And that really sealed the deal, because there were certain elements in how we were working together that made it even easier. than doing yoga on your own. You know, it was, yeah.
Thank you. That's my question for you, is how integral do you think Don's presence was to that experience?
Very, very, very important. Yeah. I mean, it gave me a sense of safety. It gave me a sense of, I can be here. I can do this. Like if I'd have been by myself, it would have been okay. Next pasture. I'd have been out of there. As well as that, you know, he was someone I had a relationship with. There was a level of trust there, right? We'd known each other for 4 years. Well, sorry, 4 months, not 4 years, for 4 months. And we'd worked together. We'd done enough with each other to be able to say, yeah, you know, he wasn't someone who didn't have my back. You know, he was there in a very supportive way. So that definitely made a difference. And that's what we teach now, you know, in our Phoenix Rising Yoga Therapy program. It's very, very important for the therapist to create relationship with the client. There has to be a connection. There has to be trust. And you can't move too quickly. You know, if someone's, and particularly someone who's had traumatic experiences in their life, you can't just deep end them into experience. It has to be done very gently and very in a very loving, caring, supportive way. And it also means you're not trying to really fix them. I mean, the other thing about that, he didn't try to tell me what I should do or what I should think or how I should do my life or none of that. Yeah, it just allowed me to engage myself in experience and in a different way rather than like going to my head to figure stuff out again. It was right there in my body. He was supporting my physical body at an edge and helping me stay with that, stay present to that, as well as be present to myself. And he reminded me a couple of times, you know, just really notice what's happening now. Be with it. Be with it. That's all it was. Be with it. Be with it and breathe and be there. And it's more than that as well, because afterwards, of course, what I did was I journaled and I used actually an integration process that I'd developed in my previous work as an organization development consultant, as a behavioral scientist. You know, I basically asked the right questions to do an integration of what had happened.
Yeah, that's, I think, such a hallmark of an experienced teacher. Because whenever I teach inversions, I don't generally speaking teach a lot of inversions, but within trainings, I'll give an intro to inversions. And I always tell people that when we work in partners, you will have this wonderful, loving, yet dangerous impulse to catch someone you think is falling out of a handstand or a headstand. And in fact, if you do that, you will both be hurt.
Right on.
And so there are ways and techniques, of course, to be present to someone's effort without interfering too much in a way that hurts the person in the supporting position.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, educator and therapist Carl Rogers, you probably heard of Carl Rogers. He was a therapist back in the 70s and an educator, much more really known as an educator, I think. And his whole concept was unconditional positive regard. Like, how can you be present to someone, allowing them to have their experience without trying to fix or change them or protect them, you know, just to allow them to engage with unconditional positive regard. It means, you know, every one of us is a human being. None of us are perfect. We're all imperfectly perfect, so to speak.
We are that. There's so many places that I could go with that, but I'm going to try to stay on track. So you've mentioned that Phoenix Rising Yoga Therapy. So that's what came to you through your experiences. Ultimately, that's what you decided to cultivate as your professional offering.
Yes.
We've had one other yoga therapist on the podcast, and yoga therapy to me seems maybe not quite as broad, but generally broad in the same way that people ask, what is yoga? Well, how long do you have? I would love to know what your definition of yoga therapy is.
Well, I wouldn't try to define it for myself or anyone else, because I think it is broad. And what I like is that it is broad. I mean, IYT, International Association of Yoga Therapy, has a definition, which I kind of like. Mainly because I think we were partly involved in helping to shape it. But it basically defines it as using the practice and wisdom of yoga to support meaningful change and greater health and well-being. I'm not exactly quoting it word for word, but it's kind of like that. So, you know, that's a pretty broad definition, and it creates a big tent for a lot of people to engage in different ways, which I like, because our approach is, you know, it has a particular focus. For me, I am interested in supporting people to become more healthy, which generally means people who are not well and need to be brought back to a state of well-being. And that's one part of the healing continuum, you know, from sick to, you know, back to functioning again. But there's a part of the continuum beyond that. And that's the part that gets into the whole area of human potential. Like, how do we, with what kind of quality do we want to engage this precious life that we have? And how do we want to be present to it and to other human beings? And how do we shift that? How do we go from just being normal to being way beyond normal, where we're really, you know, engaging our world and engaging our life with more love, more compassion, more openness, more awareness, more wisdom, all of those things. And that's possible. And yoga, you know, the ancient teachings of yoga and the eight limbs really have inherent within them that kind of a process. But it now needs to be applied in a modern world. We're not back in those days anymore. So a lot of those ancient rituals and practices, whilst they were relevant then, don't have as much relevance today. But there is still the essence of them. There's the essence of what was taught still is important, still matters. And now neuroscience is showing us that that's very true, that people can, in fact, shift their way of being. People can transform. People can change. And it's really a lot to do with how we be present to the life that we have. And so that's what excites me about yoga therapy. And that's the area of yoga therapy that I like to work in. Not that we don't work with people who need to, you know, to come back to the middle path of being okay again, to function in the world. That is important too. I'm knocking that. And I'm very pleased a lot of my colleagues in the yoga therapy profession choose to focus on that end of the spectrum. Mm-hmm. And that's great.
So I like to refer to yoga as such a wonderful bait and switch. You know, people show up because it's a good workout, or they've been told it will improve their golf game. Yeah. And then like you, like me, they figure out I'm a better person mm-hmm. for doing this. I'm more awake in my life. I'm a happier, kinder human for doing this. And so they stick with it. So, you know, I don't think there are too many yoga teachers out there who necessarily advertise. I mean, especially if they're coming from a more anatomy physiology based background, right. Let's explore your human potential.
Right.
Yoga classes now.
Yeah.
So is that, I mean, perhaps at this point in your career, but is yoga therapy different in that way? Do you like to set the expectations differently in yoga of what you can expect out of yoga therapy than basic yoga classes?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't want to be elitist about this, because I think, you know, we all have a role to play. There's purpose to everything. And I think, you know, what's happening in the popularization of yoga, you know, even some of the weird stuff that people in the yoga world kind of, you know, poo-poo. I mean, I don't personally engage goat yoga, but, you know, it's a thing now. and so what? You know, it's like, or people who teach in brew pubs, you know, it's like, it's another way of getting something out there that's beneficial and good. Is it the same as what some other more advanced or more skilled yoga therapists might be doing or offering? No, it's not there, but it's a way in, it's a doorway, you know, and it serves a purpose, and it serves a great purpose because, yeah, like you said, people start to engage it, and it is like a little bit like a bait and switch. Once you start to experience, that's the wonderful thing about yoga, I think, is experience becomes your teacher. Mm. Once you have an experience of yourself in a different way, you don't need anyone telling you how you should do this. Once you've had that experience, it's like, hey, yeah, I want to do this because this makes a difference to the way I show up in my life.
Yes.
And so that just then continues until you get to a point of saying, well, you know, I can really show up in a way that's going to work better. I really, and this happened to me not so long ago. You know, I got to a point of getting a little complacent in my relationship with my wife now. Now we have three children together, and I have two from my first marriage. So a big family, you know.
You're an experienced dad.
I am an experienced dad. Yeah. They've all taught me something too. That's the other beautiful thing. But I got to this point is I want better quality relationships with my spouse and with my children and their partners, you know. I want a better quality relationship with my grandchildren. And what does that mean? Well, you know, I explored that, but I didn't explore it in my head. I went to my body and I felt it, and I felt relationship. Yeah, what is that? And I asked myself questions from the inside, not from my head, but from deep inside. What am I looking for? And the word that came to me was love. I want to deepen love. So I made it a point of exploring that, you know, like in my postures, in my way of being, and just deepening into that feeling. And some wonderful things came to me. You know, it's like one of them was like love is a verb, not a noun. You know, love's about doing things, not about saying things, not about thinking things. It's about actually taking a little action here and there, you know. And so I started to think, well, one of the things I can do is every day I can engage some act of loving kindness and make that part of my yoga practice. You know, that's yoga too, karma yoga, you know. So how do I serve those that I love? How do I show up in a way that's going to make their life a little better, a little easier? And engaging that on a daily basis. And that made a huge difference in my life. And that came not from my thinking, just came from the inside. That's what my body, my whole being, my essence was calling me towards at that particular time in my life. And I think all of us have at any given time in our life, we got something on the front burner, something we want to step into, a greater way of being, a different way of being. And oftentimes we don't even know what that is. But when we go and we engage either in a deep experience of yoga through a class that's set up for, you know, the purpose of transformation, or a group, we run yoga therapy groups, or a one-on-one session. Someone who's really trained in transformational process through yoga can actually help someone get in touch with, first of all, where do I want to go? Where the hell am I now? Because you can't deny that. You can't get anywhere unless you say, this is where I'm at. And sometimes it's not pretty. But being present to that reality is like very important, and being okay with that. No, we're not perfect. Yes, we make mistakes. Yes, we do stupid, crazy things. But where do we want to go? You know, and what's going to fuel that? And I think that makes a very big difference at an individual level. And it also, I think, slowly but surely, I think it will change our world.
I think a lot of people, I think what you're pointing to is that a lot of people don't trust themselves.
Oh, for sure. It's very difficult to in the world we live in now.
We're perpetually told you shouldn't.
we're bombarded with images, with information, with shoulds and shouldn'ts and do's and don'ts. And yeah, it's just a complete bombardment. And if you can't really withstand that, you've got to notice that that's what's happening. But how are you going to choose to be with it? That's the big question. Are you going to be a victim to that, or are you going to walk your own path? You know?
Yeah. So I want to ask you a little bit about sort of how one becomes a yoga therapist. Let's talk a little bit about credentialization.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
I feel that we live in a slightly credentials obsessed culture. I'm the child of baby boomers. And one of my friends, her mom was president of the architectural firm that built a few different Olympic villages, and she only has a high school degree. You know, it's just, and that's crazy to us now. That would never happen. You know, you would need a PhD in engineering or architecture or business to hold that kind of position. And the yoga world is not immune to that.
Sure.
You know, we're all trademarking and battening down the hatches on our own personal systems.
Yeah.
However, the other side of that is that it does stem from a desire for right action and proper care of our students.
Yeah, yeah.
On the other hand, I'm flipping between hands here, Michael. There's wisdom and there's knowledge. And the former is often gained through experience and the latter is reaffirmed through practice and sharing. But that takes time. Some people are really gifted for particular work or they have a strong personal sadhana. Mm-hmm. So I want to know, how does your training try to account for the huge disparity of skills that yoga trainees walk into the classroom with? Because you could have someone who's had a psychotherapy practice for 30 years.
Sure. It doesn't matter, mean they're going to become a great yoga therapist. You know, it doesn't mean that at all, or anybody for that matter. So credentials, you know, the way I see it is, it's probably useful for setting a bar in some way, but it doesn't really tell the whole story. Just because someone's got, you know, letters after their name, or they've got a yoga therapy certification, doesn't necessarily mean much. It really comes down to, you know, what happens in experience, what happens when the rubber meets the road, you know. You know, my personal integrity won't let me just churn out people with a piece of paper and say, you know, here's your degree and take their money and basically just fill their head full of knowledge. That's not to me education. And it's as my integrity as an educator won't let me do that. So I play a tough game in a way, where I demand much higher standards, and standards that include skills, knowledge, application, and wisdom. Discernment, such a key thing. And a skilled yoga therapist, to me, is someone who really has, to some extent, mastered discernment in their own life and can apply it in how they choose to be with their clients. And sometimes that takes a while to learn, and it's not an easy path. So I rely heavily on great mentors, great teachers, who get that. And part of my training, I do a lot of my time now is spent in preparing for the next wave and training my teachers. And so it's very personal and it's very specific and it's very important that there are concepts and elements that, and not only understand, but they can actually apply. And that's my own take on it. Now, where does that land in the wider world? Well, I know that there are some colleagues who share that view and who really do much the same thing in their particular emphasis, the emphasis on yoga therapy that they choose to make important. Different people have different emphasis, and that's fine. And some don't. But you know. You know, I'm thinking because we're so good now at communicating with each other through, you know, social media and whatever, and also people talking to each other. I mean, our work mostly succeeds. I would say most of the people who come because they've talked to someone who's had a great experience. And so that matters. You know, it matters. If we're not helping people with their lives, then what are we doing? You know, that's what it's about. So, you know, my bottom line is it's got to work. It's got to be effective. It's got to land. It's got to be supportive and helpful to people. Otherwise, why do it? And, you know, we will discern that too in our trainings. And we get a few people from time to time who just want the quick and easy. And they're not in the right place if they come to us. You know, it's like there are probably other places they can go, unfortunately, but that's how it is. You know?
Yep. Yep. So I want to switch still to credentials, but not necessarily your definition of credentials.
Well, I probably didn't answer the question too well.
No. I think it was a terrific answer. I think you touched on your ethical responsibility, but also the challenges of the field. Right? That's we are all private institutions.
I just want to say one other thing. I'm very proud to be a member of the IAYT, International Association of Yoga Therapists, and I think they do a great job. I think the thing that I get from it is collegiate connection and just an overall awareness of what each other are doing professionally. And I have some great colleagues within the IAYT who do different forms of yoga therapy than what I do. And then that's wonderful. I really value those connections and those relationships. I value the integrity that the IAYP has attempted to set up in credentialing and all of those things. So I'm all for it. At the same time, I'm very pleased, and I wouldn't be part of it if it didn't allow me to focus on those areas of yoga therapy that I think were ones that I'm, you know, that matter to me.
And that's a huge challenge for any registry. Now, I'm going to ask you about what happened with Yoga Alliance and yoga therapists, but is the IAYT, are they more regulatory or are they still just registry?
It's still a registry. Yeah, there's no licensing as yet. No.
Yeah, licensing and oversight, et cetera.
It's under discussion, but it hasn't happened.
Yeah. I mean, maybe if I were a founding member of Yoga Alliance or on one of their advisory boards, maybe I would have a similar experience, but I am highly critical of Yoga Alliance, like so many other people in my position. And a few years ago, Yoga Alliance, I remember when it happened, but it was peripheral to my experience because I'm not a yoga therapist. But a few years ago, Yoga Alliance insisted that yoga therapists clarify that that certification was not provided by Yoga Alliance if they chose to maintain their registered yoga teacher designation.
Yeah, yeah.
And at the time, you wrote a blog post offering a few suggestions and critiques.
I did, yes.
Including that people get behind the International Association of Yoga Therapists, right, which you're a founding member. So how does IAYT operate differently than YA?
Well, I think it's all in flux. I mean, I think Yoga Alliance has done a pretty good job over the last year or two to really come to terms with some of the stuff that was not working for them. I'm not currently up to date, so I can't speak, you know, authoritatively on that. But I do see genuine attempts to move in a different direction. To cut them a little slack, I mean, they appeared on the scene at a time when the popularization of yoga was in full swing, you know, and it was like hundreds of people wanting to become yoga teachers, and they didn't really know what that meant and what that involved. And so they did the best they could with what they had at the time. And it was really interesting because Yoga Alliance grew out of an organization that I was connected with back in the 80s and 90s, which was a movement called Unity in Yoga.
Yes.
Which I loved. Unity in Yoga was a great, a great coming together of people in the yoga world where there was, you know, there would be conferences where it wasn't about egos. It was more about, you know, everybody's got a part to play. So it grew out of that. And then, of course, it morphed into what it became and what it's, and now it's morphing again. So it's an ever-changing world. And, you know, I personally am a member. We have a program registered with Yoga Alliance. It's not our main focus, but we do teach yoga teachers, particularly 300-hour, who want to learn more of the, you know, the deeper elements of yoga, the upper limbs of yoga, so to speak, and work with people who want to be more present, more mindful, more awake, which is great. But our main focus is yoga therapy, and I think the relationship has healed somewhat. Yoga Alliance and Yoga and IAYT board members are talking to each other and attending each other's events again.
It's not like West Side Story.
No, there's a coming together there. And let's face it, there's something that bonds us together, whether we're a yoga therapist or a yoga teacher, and that is a deep love and respect for the tradition. And a lot of the essence, like there's an essence to yoga that you, and as we said earlier, you know, if you practice it long enough, you can't but help be affected by it. And so, you know, in a way, we're all on the same path. And I even go even broader than that. You know, a lot of people now are into mindfulness and meditation. And to me, the Buddha was a yogi. And so the whole mindfulness movement, which stems from Buddhism, is really a part of the yoga tradition in many ways. And so it's a big world. It's a big, wide world of people who are. And the thing I think that is common to all of us is we want to create a better life for ourselves and for others. That's primarily it.
Yes.
And so, you know, if we can get together and collaborate and talk about that, however, whatever forums we set up to do that, I think that's great.
Well, I think there's some of the currents in the wider world seeping into yoga, in that people are afraid of disagreement. They do heavily disagree, but then they just want to bring people into their camp. But the positive thing about disagreeing is that, like you said, it's all out of a profound love for the practice, but agreement is never going to happen. So let's just put that out of our heads as an option, because having disagreements furthers our understanding and invites us to grapple with the process.
Yeah. And there's ways to engage. I think that's what it comes down to. I mean, like a disagreement that's taken to extremes becomes divisiveness. And, you know, divisiveness is not healthy, because we're all human beings living on the same planet. I mean, the astronauts who've been out there and beyond the planet will tell you that. They look back here and say, hey, we all inhabit that one rock, you know, that's it. And so, you know, at a global level, we need to get along together and not be as divisive, as divided as we are. Even within our country, you know, the division that is here right now is not healthy. It's not helpful. And we need to find ways to begin to talk to each other, rather than, you know, sleep in our own camp and reject the other guys. that just doesn't cut it for the long term. And I think as yogis, we have some helpful ways of helping people engage interpersonal relationships and engage collegiate relationships, you know, with greater awareness, greater compassion, greater understanding. Because basically what we're all trying to do is in fact the same thing. We're just going about it in different ways.
You've mentioned that practice is obviously off the mat. It's in our interpersonal relationships. It's with family. It's with colleagues. So I'm going to phrase this in a way that's specific to practice, but feel free to interpret that how you want.
Okay.
In your blog post on personal sadhana, personal practice, you lay out a very specific order of your practice that you follow. But earlier in the post, you talk about how you struggled with the repetition of ashram practice, until you realized that it was a teaching moment and you were getting too hung up on the content.
Right.
And so I want to ask, how should practice balance repetition and growth through repetition, but also responding to needs of the present moment?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think both are true. You know, I think we've got to go with what is, but I think a practice, see, the idea of a practice, there are really two elements to the transformational process. There's the knowledge and the wisdom, but there's also the application or the practice, or the practice beforehand, which will in fact give rise to the knowledge and the wisdom. So they kind of go together. Now, it's, I think, where we get hung up is around what we like and don't like. This like-dislike thing is the thing that gets us caught, because we live in a culture and in a world where we've been brought up through the last, particularly the last 20, 30 years, that you can have whatever you want, and you've got to be empowered, and you've got to have your way, you know, what you want, that's what really matters. And so that's great. There's a wonderful element to that, but at the same time, it's got us into this like-dislike thing. So if I'm doing a particular yoga posture, and I'm like, oh, I don't like this one, I'll do a different one. Or I don't like this particular teacher, I won't practice with him. Or, you know, I don't like this particular sequence. Well, it's not about what you like. It's about what works for you and what doesn't. And for me, I mean, some of the practices I engage, I don't necessarily like, but I know they work. Like when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is my practice. Now, many, many, many mornings, I'd much rather stay in bed, or I'd much rather skip it. I don't like doing it some days, particularly if I'm traveling on the road, I'm in a hotel room, I can't even find a space to do it. You know, I don't like it. But that's not the point. The point is, how do I want to show up today? And what's going to support that? And so how can I find a way to engage this? Because it matters, you know? So that's it's self-discipline, but it's self-discipline from purpose, not from just habit or, oh, I got to do this, or I should do this, or I got to cross this off the checklist for the day, you know. It's not about that. It's about what's going to help you with your life. And in order to find that out, sometimes you've got to engage something for long enough. Like in my case, when I lived in the ashram and I did the same practice every day for 15 months, right? Same practice. I only missed about 4 days in a year and a quarter.
Slacker.
Yeah, it was bad because I had the flu, but, you know. I could have said, this is boring. Or I could have said, this is not what I would like. And it wasn't what I liked. I didn't want to get up at 4:30 and, you know, go to a big room full of people who are still half asleep and not wanting to be there either, you know. But I did because of what I could see was shifting in my life as a result of it. But I had to be with it long enough to see that. First 3 months, I couldn't tell. First 3 months, I was just, oh, bored, you know, let's do some different postures. I went to the guru and said, you know, hey, we need to have some different postures. He said, well, if you need different postures, you're not paying attention. And he was right. You know, I wasn't paying enough attention to the practice. And once I started paying more attention, it started to change my life. You know, and sometimes it doesn't matter that much. But it's really about how you choose to be with it.
Because this is this whole series is sponsored by the yoga business school, The Catalyst, I'm ending each interview with three standard questions, but I think you've already answered the first, which was the most meaningful change sparked by your practice. I think we've covered that in detail. But you and I, we've both touched on how you have to be able to hold duality in mm-hmm. your practice. Mm-hmm. And so practice helps us evolve over time. Yet we also arrive at radical realizations in an instant, right? Mm-hmm. Hence the importance of that incredibly long period of practice is that you can do it and you never know when that epiphany is going to land.
Right.
So what are the specific ways you try to support your students' evolution, trying to hold this duality?
So, I like to teach largely experientially. Some knowledge is important, but experience is the greatest teacher to me. And so I think people, once they have an experience that makes a difference, they begin to change. So my goal in teaching is to, even in a short weekend workshop, is to gently guide people into the kinds of experiences of yoga, both individually and in, you know, hands-on work, and with insight and meditation practices as well, that give them a different way of being with themselves and give them a different way of even engaging and seeing themselves or experiencing themselves. And it's not a head thing, because most of us are very, very used to doing stuff through our head. So we don't need to do more of that. In fact, we need to do the opposite. We put it aside for a while. It doesn't mean say it's the enemy. The head is not the enemy at all. It's a very useful tool. I couldn't negotiate the subway in New York without it. You know, but it's not the be-all, end-all. It has its purpose, and there are places where we need to just get out of it and come to our body and come to being here now. So a lot of it's present-centered awareness, a lot of it's embodied. So I guide people into the kinds of experiences that bring them to a very deep sense of presence to themselves through their body. I help people to process from an integration process after the experience. So in the experience, we leave the head alone. But when we come out of the experience, we reflect and we ask questions about, you know, what did I notice and how does that connect with my life and what do I want to do with that? What's my big intention in life? What's on the front burner for me right now? So people who come to my workshops and classes generally go away with some sense of where they are in their life, where they want to go, and some of the tools that are going to help them get there if they choose to engage them. And if I can leave people with that, Even if it's only a 2-hour workshop, you know, it's something, it's a takeaway that makes a difference or can potentially make a difference in someone's life.
That beautifully feeds into the last question, which is, what change do you hope to catalyze in the larger yoga community?
Yeah, well, there are things that I'd like to see happen, but I'm also very much a realist and see things as they are. And I see things evolving anyway. So I'm not wanting to go out there and make people different right away. I mean, I think we're on a good path and things are working. But what I would like, I mean, I think the practice of yoga has become a little slanted towards the body, which is only the third limb of yoga. There isn't a whole lot of awareness around pratyahara, which is really walking through the bridge or the door from outer experience to inner experience.
Oh, I like that. That's a good description for pratyahara.
So there isn't a lot taught around that or engaged around that. A lot of the yoga classes that people go to may not be getting, you know, that deeper transition into yoga, and there has to be a readiness for it. Of course, it's not just for everybody at any old time. You know, there's an awareness that's necessary, and a readiness, and a way of being. And I think the skills of the teacher really matter here. So I'd love to help teachers become more skilled by being, you know, trained in some of these methods, either through a 300-hour bridge or through a yoga therapy training. Where they can begin to deepen their capacity to guide people into the more deeper elements of yoga, as well as the physical. I mean, the physical matters too. That's one of the three limbs, and it's an important limb, as is pranayama, as are the yamas and niyamas. But then when we get to pratyahara, we start to get into concentration, meditation, samadhi, and that's where the gold is for me. So I like to help people cross that bridge.
Thank you so much for your time this morning, Michael. It's been a very rich conversation.
Thank you, Catherine. I enjoy talking with you too. I think you share certain concepts that really resonate and has enabled, you know, a great conversation. So I'm very, very thankful.
Good, good. And if people wanted to connect with you in person, I'll be seeing you hopefully at the Toronto Yoga Conference. Fantastic. So the Canadians can find you at the end of March.
Yeah, I have a big schedule there. So I think I'm there for 4 days and I've got a workshop just about every day. So yeah, it'd be great to see people at Toronto Yoga Show. It's a great conference too.
Terrific. And then you're also, I mean, you said that you're scheduled all the way to 2020. So
pretty much. I still have a few openings in my schedule. So if anyone's interested in that, Yama Talent is my agent, and Lauren or Ava can kind of help find me. And I'd love to travel. I'm going to be in Houston later in this year, and of course Taipei, but and other places too. I can't remember exactly the schedule, but
do you possibly remember Bhavani from Kripalu?
I do.
Oh my goodness, she makes me laugh.
Beautiful voice too.
Yes, I try to get in with her whenever I'm there. And I remember sitting back and thinking, wow, this is a person comfortable with self-promotion, because she was like, and you can pick up my CDs. And you wouldn't expect it from her. She's like, you can pick up my CDs. Visit you. Please invite me to your studio. And I'm like, oh, we could all learn a lot from this person.
Well, while we're at it, I'd love to do more conferences. So if you know of a conference where they could use me, let me know.
I will think about that, but I am so impressed by the Toronto Yoga Conference. It really has kept education first.
Ruth does an amazing job bringing together a lot of great teachers and providing some great stuff. Yeah.
I will make sure that all of your stuff is linked off of the show notes so people will be able to find you. And hopefully I see you in March. Thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah. Thank you, Catherine. Have a great day.
You too. Bye for now. So a little admission, yogis, is that before you listen to what you heard, We struggled to get the software to work because Michael needed to be on a specific kind of software. Anyway, Michael saved the day. And so the recording is exactly as you hear it. I was not able to edit anything. And so a testament to what a wonderful professional he is. If you'd like to find Michael's links, you'll find them on the show notes on the website, as previously mentioned. And you'll also see him at the Toronto Yoga Conference. He said that it was in April, and it often is, but this year it's the last weekend of March. So March 28th to 31st. Hopefully we see you in Toronto. But either way, namaste for now, yogis.